This is Robin Hubbard, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 28th of October 2011. Robin Hubbard.
Well, I'm called Robin Hubbard, but I was actually christened Robert. I've never ever been called Robert. Edward Hubbard. And I was born in a place called Barnston on the Wirral in the 29th of January 1942.
So you're now
69.
And you went to school in the Liverpool area, I guess?
Yes, I went to Liverpool College, which is a private school, but it's sort of largely day boys.
And then to university?
Yes, I went to Liverpool University as well. I don't think we could afford to send me away.
What were you reading?
I read dentistry.
Why the fascination with dentistry?
Well, I don't know, really. By mistake, I would say. I remember once the headmaster of the junior school came round and said, "I want all you boys who know what you want to do when you leave school to let me know what it is." So I had no idea at all. Did I want to be a sailor or a soldier or something like this? And they came to the guy next to me and said, "I want to be a dentist." I said, "Oh." So I want to be a dentist too.
Really?
And he went on to become a civil engineer. And then after that, I was thinking, well, I don't know. Here I am sort of seemed to be heading me for dentistry, but I'm not really sure how keen I am on that. Mm. So I think maybe I'll think of something else. But no, my parents kept sort of saying, no, you're going to be a dentist. So I became a dentist.
Any regrets all these years later?
Well, I never particularly enjoyed dentistry, which is why I've always done jobs in interesting places like Antarctica and Canada and Borneo and things like this.
So dentistry was a tool in your kit bag to get around the world?
Well, sort of, yes. Yes.
And how did the Antarctic first appear in your life?
Well, the first job I did was in Dundee. I was a house surgeon in oral surgery in Dundee. And one of the nurses there had a father who was a flight lieutenant in the Air Force and had flown in the Antarctic. So I went round. I went round to their house one evening and I saw this guy's films. And here is a chap doing some dentistry. And that was a guy called Ian Barnes. I think he became a professor or something or other. I said, "Oh, interesting." I sort of tucked it at the back of my mind. And then after that I went and travelled around America for a couple of months and then did a locum job in Britain and. Then all of a sudden I didn't have a job to do. I thought, what should I do? I know. So I telephoned the British Antarctic Survey and got on to Bill Sloman, and 6 weeks later I set sail.
Had you read about the Antarctic as a boy?
Not particularly, no.
Seen the film?
No.
No? So you didn't know much about it, really?
Well, I've always been interested geographically, I'm sort of pretty good geographer these days. I knew about it geographically.
Was Bill Sloman, was he looking for a dentist?
No, I said, "Hello, I was just wondering if you're needing a dentist." They said, "Dentist? Oh, well, I suppose we could use one. Are you interested?" I said, "Well, yes." And then six weeks later.
6 weeks?
Yeah.
So did you have an interview, or was that all?
Yes, I went down to London for the day on expenses, which struck me as pretty nice at the time. And I met Bill Sloman. Whether I met Vivian Fuchs at that stage, I don't know. I can't remember.
Do you remember it being a rigorous interview, or was it almost an old boys chat?
Almost an old boys chat, yes.
Yeah. And were you surprised to be taken on?
Well, I was quite pleased. I don't recall being surprised, no.
Well, I should say, were you surprised at how quickly the turnaround was?
Well, probably, yes.
Yeah.
But I didn't really realise how most people were sort of signed up, you know, 6 months at least in advance.
But I guess you had to catch the boat, didn't you?
Yes.
How did you get down there?
On the Pearl of Dan, which was a chartered Danish ship, about 1,300 tonnes, as I recall, maybe it was 1,600, only 1,000 and something tonnes. And it was... It went along about 9 knots and took about 3 weeks to Montevideo and a couple of days in Montevideo and another week to the Falkland Islands, as I recall.
How were you taking to this? Because this is a very different way of life, I guess, being on a ship with all these men heading the same place.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And when you got there?
When I got...
To the Antarctic. What impressed you about it? What are your first impressions?
Well, I was just intrigued and fascinated, and more or less as I expected, I suppose. But I went round everywhere where the British people had a base at that time, like to Halley Bay and South Georgia and all down the Antarctic Peninsula as well.
So were you a kind of a flying dentist or a shipping dentist? You...
Well, it's both, basically I slept on the ship, apart from 2 weeks when we did a Decker Hyphex survey of some place south of Anvers Island, as I recall, when the cook, Bernie Chappell, and myself and this Decker Hyphex engineer were camped on this island for 2 weeks, just about the end of the season, probably, so it got fairly cold and windy.
They didn't need a dentist on that trip, I suppose. You were there in a different capacity?
No, I was cooking, in fact, because Bernard was totally jarred off with having been cooked for a couple of years. And he didn't want to cook a thing ever again. So I did it.
So it was a good opportunity, a jolly.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, for sure.
Let's go back to your being a ship-based dentist. In fact, even now, the dentists tend to be on ships all the time.
That's right.
50 years later. So... were you simply just going around looking for bad teeth?
I would get to a place, you know, a base where they had, and we would relieve them because they hadn't seen anybody since the end of the previous year, and I would look at all their teeth and do anything I found, and then after that I would sort of join in with whatever was happening, work on the building site perhaps.
So you became a GA effectively.
Yeah.
For a while.
Yeah.
What are your memories of that that period? Your first trip, your first visit was to Halley, I think, was it? No.
Deception and Cygne, and then Halley. No, I think it went. Before that, we went to South Georgia for 2 or 3 days.
Deception, Cygne, then South Georgia.
Yeah.
Well, they had their own dentist, I think, didn't they, at South Georgia? Is that right?
Oh, I don't think so.
No. Were you doing any dental work there?
Probably a couple of scraps only, because there were no people on South Georgia at the time. Although there's a Shackleton base, Shackleton hut, and I don't really recall what they had in the way of personnel, but I don't think they had too many.
Were you finding at Deception and Cygne? Were you finding there were problems with people's teeth, or was it all? Were your skills required, shall we say?
Oh, yes, I think so. Yes, I mean, I know I kept a diary of all that I did and a description of the dental state and everything I did for everybody. And basically, I saw most of the people. And basically, they'd been there all winter and hadn't seen a dentist, you know, for about a year or at least a year. And they tended not to be very good in oral hygiene. And they all needed at least a scaling and... a couple of fillings, and some people needed quite a few fillings, as I recall.
How well kitted out was the surgery on the ship?
Not really. I took my box of tools, which is a little wooden case, and they had a drill, which had two speeds, which this drill lived around. The drill was a motor which sat on the patient's chest, was held on by a leather strap around their neck. It had two speeds. Slow and not so very slow.
Were you able to do what you wanted, or were you compromised by the equipment?
I didn't have any X-ray machines, so there were a couple of times when I could have done with some X-rays. Basically, you had to... Lack of X-rays was a real thing that I missed, and then I didn't have a high-speed drill, except that in my training, I'd only been using high-speed drills in the last year or something like that.
Anaesthetics? Were you able to give people an anaesthetic?
Local anaesthetics, yes. Yeah.
So it wasn't that bad?
No.
But it could have been better?
Basically, in the Pearl of Dan, I used the bathroom in the cabin I shared with Dick Williams, who's a doctor, who's Australian. So I just use our cabin bathroom. And then after probably at Halley Bay, I changed onto the John Biscoe. And again, I think I used a bathroom on the John Biscoe.
So the high speed drill, the slow speed drill, you took with you. It was actually on the ship already.
Yes. I think the high speed, the low speed drill belonged to BAS.
Right, but you took you transferred it from one ship to the next with you.
I think so.
Yes.
Actually, I don't really. I'm sure I did. Yes, must have done.
The ships didn't come equipped with a drill.
No.
Okay. And you had you had the great opportunity to see around the whaling station at South George, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
What were your feelings about that?
Well, it wasn't operating at the time, which I was fairly glad about. Yes. And I went to see Sir Ernest Shackleton's grave. And then when I went back to South Georgia towards the end of the trip, I went and had a good couple of hikes up on the ridges after they'd been snowed upon. So that were in some beautiful weather. So I thoroughly enjoyed that. But basically, I have at home a harpoon head, which I took home, sort of stolen from the base, I suppose. But there was no whaling. I think whaling had finished at that time, hadn't it?
I think you probably, yes. Yeah. It would have been an old whaling station, but probably still in fairly good condition compared to how it was a few years ago.
Yes, there were a few whale hunters around, little small boats with guns on the foredeck.
Well, a lot of people have a lot of affection for South Georgia, for its beauty and...
Yes,
vegetation
indeed.
And bird life.
Yes.
Were you struck by that?
Absolutely. Yes, and the water was so beautiful and clear and blue, and the weather was pretty good as well when I was in South Georgia.
Gosh.
So,
you
yes.
were lucky. Tell me about the other things you had to do, because apart from dentistry, which was the skill you arrived with, you had to pick up skills at other things, such as hair cutting and so on.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Well, I really quite enjoyed hair cutting, and I remember one guy coming in from in Halle Bay who had been out travelling for 3 months or so, and came in with his hair down his shoulders and a big beard and things like this. Came to be trimmed up by me, and I have a before and after photographs of him. One was all shaggy and his hair down over his shoulders and a big beard. Another all trimmed and neat.
Was that something you'd already learned how to do anyway? Because
no, but I've always sort of. I tend to do my own hair, actually, as well. So
you volunteered to...
Yes.
Yeah.
And I did him. He was the guy who came in with the most hair, but I think I did two or three others as well. Another thing we did was we took out George McLeod's appendix.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I'd quite like you to talk me through that whole process.
Oh.
Because you were in the room at the time, weren't you?
Yes, I was, yes. Well, so were three doctors, in fact.
John Brotherhood is one of them, I think.
John Brotherhood was one of them.
And talk me through it.
Well, we had to go down to the bowels of the earth, which is probably the Halley 1 or something, which is about 60 feet down these lift shafts. And we get to this place, and I was really just like a sister, and I didn't really have a particular job to do, I don't think. Maybe I passed the sutures and things like this, but there were three doctors doing it, and one of them doing the anaesthetic, and I don't recall which it was.
What were the conditions like under which you were working?
Well, it was all right, except the one of the walls was ice, and there wasn't a single right angle in it, because everything sort of tends to warp under flowing ice, doesn't it? And it was about 60 feet down below the surface.
Was there plenty of light, then? Electric light?
As I recall, there must have been, yes. But I know it was a particularly difficult appendix because it had been sort of grumbling on for several years. Right. So it was all sort of sclerosed up and things like this. So it wasn't... You didn't just get in, expose the appendix and sort of snip it off and remove it. It just had to be detached from all its... All the...
neighbouring organs.
Yes.
Yeah. So Fuchs says it took quite some time to find it in ice and men.
Well, it probably did, yes. This was an awful long time ago, you know. But I remember three doctors, one of whom was John Brotherhood, and the other one was probably Dick Williams, and then there was a third guy as well, whom I don't recall. No, he did go to Canada, this third guy. Who was... Do you know his name?
I'll have to look it up, I think it's over here. I was reading it before. In fact, I wasn't. That was...
Yeah.
Yes, I was. Here we go. Ron Lloyd.
Ron Lloyd. Anyway, he since moved to Ontario, and I was in touch with him by letter about 10 years ago.
Did he have a sense that you were making history by performing this appendectomy in the Antarctic?
Perhaps, yes.
So when the operation was complete, what happened to the patient?
Well, that's a good question, because I don't really know. I'm sure he was bandaged up and had to go and recuperate for a couple of weeks.
He was transferred to the ship. Do you remember that much?
No.
No. Okay.
No. Another thing I recall is that a dog had been run over by a sledge. The dog was called Casey, and she came in with the skin sort of... Anyway, I remember assisting and doing probably about 30 or 40 sutures into her.
How was she in the end?
She died.
Uh-huh.
Alas.
Yes.
But that was quite fun to do. I think she died a few weeks later, where it was not apparently as a result of all the trauma she'd undergone, I think.
You were lucky, really, because you were a dentist, you were travelling around from base to base, you probably got to see more of the Antarctic than most people.
I think so, yes.
So where else did you find yourself?
I remember seeing the South Sandwich Islands, because they had the only, at that stage of my life, the only live volcano I'd at that stage seen. So there's one smoking away. Then we went down to Antarctica. Down to Halibay, and after that we went to the Argentine Islands. Mm. Possibly we called in at Sydney first, but I'm not sure about that. So I went down to the Argentine Islands, which were actually, and since then I've been back for, we did this cruise in 2000, which you were on, weren't you?
Margaret Bay trip, yes.
Yeah, well, the ice was completely different at that stage. It was far, far icier. And it seems to have retreated from the rock edge by about 40 feet or so. And there were a couple of dead planes or up on Fuchs Ice Piedmont. And we used to go and ski jaw around them.
Again, you were involved in relief work and shifting bags of coal, I seem to.
Yeah, that was at Stonington, yes.
Yeah.
And I think these sacks weighed 150 pounds or something like that. 100 weight and a half or something like that, and it was the first time you tried to pick one up, you couldn't shift it, and after a while, you were sort of practically throwing them around.
Because you got stronger, or you got used to it, or the muscles tone?
I don't know.
Developed?
I don't know, but it was a lovely day, and I remember doing it with my shirt off, as were several of us. There's not a breath of wind, and it was about -5 or something like that. Baking hot, it felt.
You also went to the American base at Palmer.
We did, yes, but I don't recall that too much. I think that struck me as a slightly sort of not very important American base, probably, and a bit run down. I think it had been a British base beforehand, hadn't it?
I don't know.
Anvers Island, yeah.
Oh, right, Anvers Island, OK. Yeah. So were you struck by a difference in the American way of doing things to the... what you've seen on the British bases?
Well, I don't think I was there long enough to notice. So I would say no. Well, I was struck by some differences, so, but I don't really recall what it was.
Okay. Right. How did you get on with sterilising your equipment? Because presumably you had to change it between patients.
We just had a boiling water steriliser. So you made sure that everything you used was boiled for 5 minutes. Which probably doesn't sound very much these days, does it? But it all seemed to work.
And how were FIDS generally with dentists? I mean, we all hate the dentist, or the joke is that people hate going to the dentist. Were FIDS any different?
No, I think most of them were quite pleased to see me. I know there's a guy called Dave Matthews who actually refused to see me. I was quite friendly with him as well, but he still refused to come and see me.
He'd rather have toothache.
Yeah, but... so I never saw his teeth.
Right.
But apart from that, it was a nice matey do, you know. Everybody's friendly with everybody.
Do you feel
yourself to be a feed, because you had a very different experience from most of the guys who were here today at the reunion.
Well, not really, no. But I did spend this two weeks on shore manning the Hyphix station, which sort of helped me rather to become a FID,
right.
I think.
So you qualify?
Yes, just about.
What else? There's a reference here to some sunbathing with not much clothing on. Is that appropriate?
When we were doing this Hyphix expedition on the island, one day was particularly nice and sunny and warm, and there was a little ice floe floating in an old melt pool or something. So we took turns to get naked on this ice floe and get photographed. But it was a bit chilly.
Yeah, I think it was.
Oh, and then another thing I did, I went swimming at Deception Island, which I didn't write down. So what happened then? Anyway, you can feel that the sea was really quite warm because of the warm springs bubbling up, and then the tide came out. And what I didn't realise was that the hot springs got clamped or quietened down by the tide, so it was actually cracking cold by the time I got into the water. And after that, so I came out so cold that the bosun gave me the whole of his rum tot for the day. They still had tots of rum in the Navy in those days, which is actually quite a lot of really strong rum. Mm. Have you ever seen a rum tot?
I've heard about them.
Anyway, they're about sort of four or five rums, I think. So I sort of swallowed this down. And after that, I woke up with a dreadful hangover.
How big a... If you look back over your life, how important are those 2 years to you? Were they, did they change you at all? What do you say?
Well, I think they. It sounds good on your CV,
yeah.
Having been to the Antarctic. So that when I next applied for an interesting, about 4 years later, I applied for this job in Brunei, and having been to the Antarctic is probably what got me that job, which is a very nice job as well.
So they were impressed by that line on your CV?
I think so, yes. And that was 3 years in Brunei with no income tax and tax-free everything and free accommodation and God knows what. So that was really quite good. And they paid me about the same as the British Prime Minister got paid in those days, which is only £6,000 a year, which doesn't sound too good now, does it? But it seemed quite a lot in those days.
And you bumped into somebody in Brunei who you'd met in the Antarctic?
Yeah, just as I was about to leave, I bumped into this Hyphix engineer who I spent 2 weeks camping on this little island with Bernie Chappell. But I was actually in a hurry because I was leaving the next day and was getting things finished off, and bumped into him in town. And I don't recall his name.
Okay. There was some talk, when I first started doing these interviews, about FIDs having dental treatment before they went south.
I think they did, yes.
You were aware of that?
Yes. So basically, they all had to be dentally fit as they went south. But they then spent one or maybe even two winters down there, perhaps not taking particularly good care of their teeth and eating who knows what. So it was quite good for them to have to be checked out.
Did the climate affect their teeth? I mean, cold weather and freezing conditions?
They said so, but I don't believe that it did. I think it was just sloppy dental hygiene and lots of sugar and things like this.
Did you have any scary moments on the ship? Any bad nights?
A katabatic wind blew in at Halley Bay. So a katabatic wind blows off the land onto the sea. So there's a lot of breaking up of the ice to which the ship was tethered. So we woke up in the morning with the ship still tethered to its ice floe, but sort of floating about a mile out to sea in this screeching wind. So I had to get back ashore. And that was sort of... It was not frightening for me, no, but it was interesting. And perhaps it was frightening for other people, I don't know.
In retrospect, perhaps it's more frightening than it was at the time.
Well, I was only on the ship at the time.
Mm.
And I sort of trusted the captain.
What were your feelings about the wildlife you came across? Did you see any spectacular examples of wildlife?
Well, lots of seals, but what we didn't see too many of was whales. We had to, all the time we were steaming around, we had to man a whale watch, so we had to go up above the bridge and count any whales. Well, all the hours I did up there, I didn't really, I saw one imagined I saw a whale in the distance, so reported it, but I don't think I did. Whereas going down in the year 2000, there were whales everywhere. Mm. Do you remember? Mm. Well, that seemed incredible compared with the way it was when I was there previously. And similarly, fur seals. There were fur seals everywhere, weren't there?
Mm.
Well, I don't think there's a single fur seal. Apparently, there's, you know, six breeding pairs around the whole continent. So that they probably have one puppy a year, and all the pups, and they probably live 30 or 40 years or something. So the population of fur seals seemed to increase it to unimaginably.
How did you take to the penguins?
Well, yes, I like the penguins, except that going down this subsequently on this Margaret Bay 2000, weren't they awfully smelly?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, I didn't really notice them smelling when I was there previously.
Well, they can't have got smellier, can they?
No, but I guess one didn't go and sort of traipse around a rookery, in a daily rookery or something like that. And one place on the probably in South Georgia, we had a king penguin on board, which was a bit dopey. So we dressed him up and put a tie on him.
A bow tie?
No, it was just a fizz tie, actually.
Right.
And put a camera around his neck, and he's just stood there looking. So I got photographs of him.
How did they get on board? Did you bring him on board, or?
I guess somebody must have done.
Yeah,
it wasn't me.
What was it? How was the ship, the John Biscoe, in those days? We're talking about the mid '60s. I mean, was it a good ship to be on, or was it bad in bad weather?
I don't know. It's a bit hard to say because the previous ship I've been on was even smaller, and that wasn't particularly good in bad weather either. But so, you know, they roll around and.
Do you ever feel nervous?
No, should I have done?
No, I'm not.
I thoroughly enjoyed being at sea. Sorry.
What? I'm not quite sure whether how you can apply Antarctic experience to Brunei, Brunei, but what do you think you brought back from the Antarctic, which you've kind of used in later life in terms of skills or abilities or just approach to life?
Nothing that I can think of, really, except that I don't really mind getting by with sort of inadequate equipment, because that's what I had to do in Antarctic, and it didn't really bother me to get along without a dental assistant as well, so I didn't mind doing things for myself.
So you became self-sufficient?
Yes.
Or but, more self-sufficient?
Well, more self-sufficient, and such that I didn't really mind being self-sufficient, whereas most dentists seemed unable to work without a couple of assistants hanging around them. Well, it doesn't bother me too much.
Was that the case then, or is that now more the case today? I mean, the dentists in the '60s had to have assistants, didn't they?
Well, I'm sure they all did have, apart from people in the Antarctic. Yes, I'm sure they've always had assistants.
Who was the captain of the Biscoe when you were on her for that season?
I don't recall who the captain was. I remember the first mate was Malcolm somebody or other, who was quite nice. And there was a South African third mate called Blood, if I can, perhaps you've got his name written down.
I haven't, no. Now, how were you treated? Were you treated as an officer of the ship, or as a FID, or a?
I'm treated as a FID, really, not as an officer, not particularly as an officer.
So
of
you
the ship.
You weren't dining at the captain's table, or?
No.
Were you glad you went?
Oh yes, most definitely. In fact, looking back in my life, that was perhaps the best thing I've done in my life, and Brunei was perhaps the next best. Since then, it's all been a bit downhill.
Oh. Well, you actually went to Canada, didn't you, for quite a long time?
For 26 years, yes.
In the northern frozen territories or further south?
No, further south, but way in British Columbia, which is the westernmost province, but on the eastern side, on the Alberta side, so in the Rocky Mountain Trench, really, which is sort of like being in the Alps because there were pretty high mountains, and there's an awful lot of Swiss people, and Austrian people, and German people who were from the Alps.
Why did you leave?
Basically, my clientele was getting pretty old, so I would do 2 weeks and not see I seem to remember doing 2 weeks without seeing anybody under about 80. So you could retire when you were 60. So I thought, well, I think I'll retire and I'll try to get a job back in Britain, because you could go and work for the community dental service and get a salary and 6 weeks paid leave.
So that's what you did.
Yes.
Back to Britain.
So I applied for jobs in various places. I only applied for jobs in places which sounded as if they might have been pleasant. And then Taunton offered me this job. I'd also applied for ones in Torquay and the Isle of Man and King's Lynn, I think.
When the Marguerite Bay trip, the Marguerite Bay 2000 trip was mooted, what was your reaction? Were you determined to go straight away, or did you think about it for a while?
I probably thought about it for a while. I think I was still in Canada at the time, wasn't I?
I think you probably were, yes.
Yeah. 2000, yes, I was. I thought, well, I'll go on that. But so I put my name down and went.
What was it like going back?
It was pretty nice to see people again. I really quite like Argentina as well, and I thought Ushuaia was pretty very pleasant. What I didn't really like particularly was you were sort of limited to the ship, weren't we? And if you got somewhere you could go for a good hike on shore, well, they didn't like you going for a hike on shore.
Were you aware how the Antarctic had changed in the intervening 40 years, 35 years?
Not really, no. Although I was probably assuming that it had, I didn't really know in what way it had changed.
Was it nostalgic or disappointment or?
What does nostalgic mean?
Well, did it conjure up memories of your trips 35 years previously?
Well, probably, yes. Yes, it did.
Such as? What are your strongest memories from your 2 years in the Antarctic, looking back at it now?
Well, first of all, I didn't go for 2 years. I was just a summer.
Sorry,
I was a summer person. I really thoroughly enjoyed this Hyphix sort of camping on Little Island. The whole thing was a joy, actually. And we did the seal hunting trip as well, which was not particularly a joy for me because I'm not really into killing things. We actually sort of slaughtered about 300 seals for dog food. I think the bosun went down with a rifle and sort of shot them in the head and then gutted them then there on the spot.
Were you ever defeated by anybody's teeth whilst you were down there?
Is I had to take a tooth out of the doctor. And it was an upper four, and upper fours tend to have twisty roots, and they do tend to have two of them. And this tooth broke. And I never succeeded in getting the roots out.
Really?
No. And I had him there for about an hour and a half or something, gouging around with elevators and heaven knows what. But still, it was refused to move at all. And it'd be nice to have had an X-ray machine for that.
Yeah. How was he afterwards?
I don't know, but he said he was all right. But I think I'm not sure that I would have been all right.
It would have carried on hurting, wouldn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, it was probably hurting because its nerve was inflamed. So having broken it off, Then the nerve was opened up, so perhaps it didn't hurt. But I'm afraid I don't really know.
Was there anything that could be done about the diet of the FIDs at the time? If the diet was contributing towards their dental problems?
Well, yes, not so much the diet as their lack of oral hygiene, I think.
They just didn't bother to clean their teeth.
Yes. So I was always telling them to brush their teeth and use their dental floss and things like this, but whether they did or not, who could say?
Okay, that's great. I think that's everything I need to ask you, Robin, unless there's something else you're keen to tell me.
Well,
he has some notes here, which I...
Yeah. There was one guy called Alistair MacArthur. Have you heard of him at all?
And the name rings a bell, yeah.
Well, I think he was the grandson of the guy who introduced Merino sheep to Australia. And he was a base leader.
Right.
Halley Bay, perhaps, Stonington, maybe. And he was quite a nice guy. But anyway, I think he's probably filthy rich now. And I know his grandfather was introduced Merino sheep to Australia. And, that's right, at the start of it, they had two other people on board. One was Monsieur Hollande, who was the Governor des Territoires Français Australien et Antarctique. So he was actually the governor of the French Antarctic Territories, and he was Crozet and places like that, and Kerguelen, I think. Mm. And he and I got on quite well together.
In what way? What was he like?
Well, he's very pleasant, as I recall, and perhaps I didn't mind practising my French on him. And there's also a guy from Alaska as well, who had this enormous telephoto lens, the biggest telephoto lens I had seen at that stage in my life.
Good. OK. Anything else on your notes? I don't want to deprive you of the opportunity.
Oh, we had a little... I tend to have to do a VD clinic once in a while when there was no doctor around. And one of the seamen from the John Biscoe, as I recall, had two eyes, an eye tattooed on each buttock, a full-sized eye. Well, a much bigger than full-sized eye tattooed onto each buttock, and he had gonorrhea. And...
How do you get? I see. He was a sailor, not he wasn't a fit. He was a sailor.
Yes, he was a sailor. Yes.
Right.
Was
that something you'd been trained to do? Clap clinic.
No, but there was nobody else to do it.
So how are you identifying these diseases?
Well, gonorrhea just by the symptoms.
Right.
I've done bacteriology course and things. I knew what gonorrhea was. It was gonorrhea, all right.
Yeah.
And I knew exactly how to treat it as well, which is just penicillin.
Mm. So you didn't have to look in the manual, or
no, didn't need to.
All right. Yes, that's rather more than you bargained for when you signed up to be a dentist, I'd imagine.
Well, yes, but I didn't really. I was signing up for fun rather than for dentistry, you know. No, to experience life.
Good. Okay. Shall we call it a day?
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.